That was John Stauber of PR Watch, author of several books on the manipulation of public opinion, interviewed by Sue Supriano. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. We'll conclude the program tonight with a speech and discussion by John McMurtry, a professor of philosophy at the University of Guelph, Ontario. McMurtry is the author of numerous books and one of Canada's foremost social critics and public intellectuals. He spoke last month at a forum in Toronto on how Canada should respond to war and terrorism, which was sponsored by the organization Science for Peace. In spite of the forum's nominal topic, McMurtry's presentation shone a spotlight over terrain similar to that covered by the Richard Moore article with which we began the program. John McMurtry.
I think we're at a turning point of history really right now. One could have said that now for 5 years. The reason I've been so prodigious, I feel completely driven by world events because I do feel we're at a very fateful moment in the history of the human race. So I'll go right to it now. I've been asked to speak on the topic, why is there a war in Afghanistan? And I could focus on the innumerable suspicious circumstances of this latest U.S. aerial war on a poverty-stricken country, its typical overriding of international law, its strategic fit with U.S. corporate designs for foreign oil resources, and the U.S. past strategic support of the very enemy said to be targeted, like Noriega, like Saddam, and like Milosevic in the past. But instead, I'm going to situate this latest U.S.-led war on a third world region within a much wider global process. I'm going to consider America's new war as the latest expression of a much deeper and wider terrorist campaign of an emergent totalitarian pattern of instituting world corporate rule with no limit of occupation or accountability beyond itself. Unhappily, it is not easy to see Canada's foreign policy role in all of this as anything other than obedient subjugation to this transnational corporate agenda at every senior level of decision-making. And I'm thinking of the trade negotiators at DFAT and all the way up to the minister when I say that. The unseen terrorist pattern. The gravest problem with corporate market fundamentalism is that it is decoupled from society's life conditions. Its entire model is. It is, in fact, incapable of recognizing any value to anything except corporate value adding, which it is assumed should regulate all peoples and all conditions of life on Earth for, quote, efficiency and maximum growth. To this point, there has been no outside margin, and this is the totalitarian nature of this project or program. There's been no outside margin to this total doctrine's demands or government subservience to them. Since the commitments of a society to safeguard the lives of its members and to ensure that they are able to express themselves as human is the measure of its civilization, this global corporate program is not merely uncivilized, it is beneath recognition terrorist in its meaning. For if we recognize the real meaning of terrorism, and I don't mean the meaning of terrorism that we've had with Bill C-35 and C-36, which effectively say, you know, as in I think Section 27, intended to cause serious interference with an essential facility or system, I think we see the disconnection of the very meanings of words from their actual natural meaning. Terror without terror. Terrorism without terror. They're talking systems, not people's terror. Now, I'm going to define terrorism with some fidelity to the actual meaning of terrorism, unlike our government laws, which are part of this global program. And I would say that the real meaning of terrorism is to instill in innocent people fear for their life security, to coerce their compliance to an armed faction's demands. And I think we see this pattern increasingly at work across World Life Organization. Under the financial dictates of the corporate market, backed by rising extremes of armed force, citizens everywhere are subjected to a low-intensity campaign of destabilization and fear that leaves no aspect of their lives secure. Now, I have a lot of documentation of this, but I won't be able to get into that today. But I think this is true even in Canada, one of the world's most well-off societies, the silent terror grows. Its vast water heritage is so in peril that people unprecedentedly die from its pollution, while our governments sign its future away to U.S.-engineered trade and investment dictates. The minds of our young are so shackled by a culture of violence and demands to buy that their capacity to think is stunted, while their public education is increasingly structured as a marketing site to reproduce students as compliant servo mechanisms, all part of the coming GATT, too, or GATS. The rule of law is cumulatively overridden by transnational trade edicts to subjugate all that exists for corporate profit. Try to find a limit. There isn't one. Riot squads club and gas unarmed opponents, and civil liberties are stripped by Orwellian security machinations. Always the threat is against life and life means. That's the design of it, and I don't think it's intent. It's preconscious. Always the threat is against life and life means to coerce compliance to corporate demands. Our country's national symbol for the hemisphere, health care for all, is degraded and privatized for profit as citizens are deprived of family positions by the hundreds of thousands. 30,000 in my own city of Guelph are without family physicians. Corporate motor commodities and schemes now so lay waste to Canada's land and water and public ways that it may be unsafe to breathe the air, walk freely, or count on a forest or aquatic habitat being there in a year. The vocation of serving fellow human and planetary life by one's daily service of work, our humanity itself, is slashed in every life function. Always the command is to turn money into more money for corporate investors or do not survive. Well, I think this is real terror. In fact, I would say it's the very threat to economic and financial security that the government legislation itself recognizes as terror is upon us. But as a structure, the U.S.-led structure here, you operate by projection. You project onto those who oppose you what you're doing yourself. It's a secret to their ideology and indeed their law of motion. The shape of this beast's ever grosser lines dwarfs the monster beheld by St. John of the Apocalypse or the boundless greed of Duryodhana of the tale told by the Mahabharata. We live, in fact, under an increasingly global reign of terror, but our disconnection from the meaning is its triumph. Instead, we're made to believe that the terror comes from pre-industrial fanatics in poor countries. The world has been usurped by a pattern familiar in the microcosm but not yet decoded at the macro level, a revolt against human society itself. The historical maturation of nations after the world's greatest depression and war was called the Great Transformation by Karl Polanyi, but the Great Reversal has not yet been publicly deciphered. Its meaning is primeval. It is the atavistic return of society to an unaccountable male gang seeking to dominate the world. We see this pattern in the 9/11 war. Its public phase began with thousands of people of mixed nationalities, most American civilians, were killed by suicide bombers of a foreign male gang of Islamic fundamentalists. The numbers, by the way, interestingly changing from 6,900 to 3,900 to 2,772, just part of this whole operation and with very little publicity. Each side then duly proclaimed the other the embodiment of evil, same story. Each repudiated the law from start to finish, same story. And both killed as many innocent people as got in the way of their war to rule other countries, same story. While the gang leaders throughout stayed unscathed behind walls of armed protectors, both called each other cowardly murderers. There is little difference in moral substance between these atavistic gangs, although a megalomaniac rhetoric of each proclaims direct backing from God. Both sides are mass killers, and both systematically destroy civilians and their means of life with sanctimonious justification, overriding all accountability to truth or due legal process. Both proclaim their mission as the work of divine justice, and both destroy the lives and human conditions of innocent others with a pathological abandon that takes the breath away. That is, in fact, their function. It is of demonstration, destructions, and killings. To command, by terror and seize whatever is wanted, with complicit governments like Canada's and Britain's barking and crouching behind, the real deal is struck beneath public notice. Incalculably more innocent people in terror in exchange for incalculably more oil supplies for U.S.-led corporations and, as a side deal, $200 billion in further giveaways of public revenues to corporations and the very rich in the U.S., another unseen aspect. But the primeval criminal gang structure is not tracked for two reasons. The first is that saturating conditioning disconnects people from reality. It is easy. Just tell the people someone is attacking them and then denounce anyone who protests as unpatriotic and a threat to the nation's security. These are Hermann Göring's words, and they transmit the code of this gang form of rule. Concealed under the most ludicrous lies, its coercion reigns supreme. Already university employees and indeed a talk show host have been unconstitutionally suspended in the U.S. for pointing out the most undeniable truths. The disorder goes to the heart of the ruling corporate psyche. Consider the pattern. Now moving into images of manliness and how the surrounding culture transmits this pattern. The adolescent group mind plots in secret, and I'm thinking of working right up to the war room. The adolescent group mind plots in secret behind the closed doors of secluded forts for control of the rest of society to maximize the gang's private take. I really think we're at an adolescent gang stage of history. Sex and violence are the ruling images of its kingdom of ever bigger deals and attacks on designated outgroups. The gang's ethos of power and control pervades the larger society with a barbaric code of acquisitive stratagem, takeover of others' territories, continuous extraction of gang tribute, and indiscriminate violence and armed force at will. Throughout group slogans and tough talk to reinforce the bonds of male and servant female bravado in the face of ever greater extremes of life deprivation, confiscation, and fear. The universal insecurity the many feel is, as the resistance grows, played back to them as what the gang is protecting them from. The logic of rule by force is then openly declared to protect them from the terror. The U.S. president declares an ultimatum to the world. You are either with us or for the terrorists. And after starving Afghanistan is carpet bombed, his administration proclaims, who will be next? Charles Krauthammer, glorious name, declares the mood in Time magazine. Quote, America is no mere international citizen. It is a dominant power in the world, more dominant than any since Rome. Accordingly, America is in a position to reshape norms. How? By unapologetic and implacable demonstrations of will. This is as the bombs fall. The extortion racket of the neighborhood is, in a word, writ large as the international war against terrorism, a war in which those who monopolize terror are licensed to exempt itself and themselves from its meaning. Lacking the resources of character to compete head-on, the global corporate gang everywhere relies on controlled images instead. And I think this is its peculiar quality. It's a kind of a public relations totalitarianism in the first instance. The image set loved most by the gang's crowds are performed around the clock. Symbolic male gangs and corporate logos attacking one another day in and day out in competitive spectacles, all constructed to glorify the riches of the winners. The never-ending sudden-death dramas hold the many in thrall, and so the actual violent struggles of life and death in the wider world are diverted from. They are displaced onto the sports or the war screen as a universal marketing site for corporations and banks. Behind the scenes, the real action goes on. Instruments of transnational trade and investment, competitive mergers and privatization and deregulation of the public sector are the deep booty system. Outside of the manufactured conflicts of the mass spectacle games the many have their hearts and minds fastened to, the world is restructured as a pay-on-time system where the payments issue more and more demand for all to pay. as this or that entertainment product wins or loses in the Colosseum, the gang's trade lawyers secretly construct hundreds of new laws behind everyone's backs in which only the rich can win, from outside the market, by the way. The new world order is backed by iron cages, starvation, rains of gas in clubs for resistors, and genocide for peoples from which the latest declared enemy comes. But few dare to name the game. And so its order is ritualized with ever more one-sided shows of mass destruction and violence discharged on the dispossessed to demonstrate the inevitability of its rule. Outside the bombing of poor peoples, whatever stands in the way of the global corporate gang's axings of expenditures on life is declared an obstacle to its freedom, in revealing slogan, a protectionist barrier. Any public law to regulate, protect, or retain control over any sector of domestic economies is prohibited. There is a prize for all this, and it is a prize without end. All free existence which corporate vehicles can reconstruct to extract profit from, without limit. In the end, the global corporate gang wages a war on life organization itself. I think it's really a metaphysical meaning here. The world and the revealing terms of the occupiers is a limitless market opportunity for, quote, maximum penetration and control. Yet in the era of the global knowledge economy, there is a vulnerability of this reign of fear and rapine which cannot be overcome. It can only work where its deep pattern evades exposure. Now I move into the final part, which I call the new totalitarianism. The deep pattern of the male corporate gang in its global form is, as David Rockefeller put it at the June 1991 Bilderberg meeting in Baden, Germany, a, quote, supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers, which is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries. As such a structure of world rule, it is accomplished by the same financial and media system deciders that put Tony Blair in office in Britain and George Bush into the White House against majority vote. Transnational corporations have marketed and financed these political leaders to ensure that captive states serve them rather than the peoples the governments are elected by, guaranteeing through state plenipotentiaries and transnational trade edicts that governments can no longer govern them in their common interest without infringing the new trade and investment laws in which transnational corporations are alone granted rights, no rights to anything else. All along, the corporate media have, as Rockefeller again advises, and I quote from the same speech, cooperated, because it's to the media, they have cooperated with this plan for the world by, quote, a discretion of public secrecy for which he thanks them. Quote, it would have been impossible for us to develop a plan for the world if we had been subjected to the light of publicity during those years. With financial and media selectors ensuring compliant party government leaders, all the requirements for this plan for the world have been set in place for a totality of control of world societies by a centralized global system which is by law not accountable to any electorate or indeed anyone or any life requirement. I'm really ashamed of our government in its submissive role in all this. The meaning of the post-September 11 bombing of Afghanistan may be best understood in the light of this background. What is important to recognize beneath all the spasms of propaganda of America's new war and the forces of good versus evil, variations on a very old theme, is that every step and preparation and aftermath of this whole new war with no end confers cumulatively more strategic, legal, and military control over the world's peoples and resources from an unaccountable U.S. financial and armed force center. That's its meaning. But the war with no end is not just for world dominion and, as it is humorously titled, a fight for civilization. The grand prize of this war is unimpeded control by multinational oil corporations over the world's greatest oil and gas deposits, which are located around the Caspian Sea of Central Asia, the former territory of the Soviet Union. I just remind you in passing that the war against Saddam Hussein, who many of you may recognize, was given the green light by the U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie a few days before the invasion of Kuwait. The key there that nobody ever talks about is 95% of the oil of Iraq is publicly owned, and the people won't give it up. Longtime U.S. strategic advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski counseled, quote, in 1997, unhindered financial and economic access to precisely these, quote, Central Asia natural resources, referring specifically, this is in the Grand Chessboard, referring specifically to, quote, this is Brzezinski again, the enormous economic prize of natural gas and oil located in the region, close quote. Brzezinski advised that in the face of domestic resistance, it will become, quote, ever more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues. And now I emphasize what he says following that. Except in the circumstances of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. It's the only way you'll be able to move in on those old oil fields. Well, this is the doctrine of total power, and it conceive of no limit to itself. As earth events interfere in resistance to the unaccountable world rule, military and police links are forged on the very sites of any resistance. Constructing and exploiting the new system requires this enemy to justify the sweeping new powers of coercion and terror which the global corporate system requires to rule an increasingly unwilling world. As in all protection rackets by terror and financial manipulation, the greatest threat to life comes from the very system of armed force surveillance and attack which is said to be protecting citizens from it. Conceptualized by presidential proclamation after September 11 as one in which everyone in every region are for us or for the terrorists, with us or for the terrorists. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick, in a less known comment, explained this meaning to include precisely those protesting against the WTO. And notice it was at the height of this that this whole incident occurred. Quote, this president and this administration will fight for open markets. We will not be intimidated by those who have taken to the streets to blame trade and America for the world's ills. That's his response to 9/11. Totality of rule is not the only parameter of totalitarianism. In Hannah Arendt's phrase, limitless of power also proceeds from an omnipresent center. In the new totalitarian movement, this omnipresent directive force communicates through global financial and media control centers with Washington and Wall Street, the dominant nodes of the interlocked system. The world's means of life and mass media are the material and the symbolic vehicles, respectively, by which the flows of goods and demand for goods control the world populations. The regulating principle of all decisions is to multiply by ever more deregulation and new financial instruments the monetized circuits of power through which directive control of all of the world's means of existence increasingly pass. The telltale sign of the totalitarian movement is that it cannot stop by its nature. It careens from one life-destructive crisis and suppression to another in supreme confidence of its limitless power and capacities until its overreach exposes it to collapse or destruction. Armed terror is not the essence, but the punctuation mark of the new totalitarianism's meaning. The money and consumption commands channel is the secret of the movement's success because it avoids responsibility for all its failures. Wall Street prescribed market failures to provide for societies are instead always attributed to transcendental forces of the invisible hand, punishing these societies for alleged sins against market laws. It's probably the most dominant superstition in the history of our race. Thus, as catastrophes increasingly befall the majority of the world, the victims are blamed for their new deprivation and misery. This is a far more effective mode of rule than jackboot terror, which is more overt, but it exposes the system to another form of resistance. For such a regime depends throughout on keeping knowledge silenced and repressed. This is its Achilles heel. As soon as people see through it and flag it to the surrounding community, the collective trance which it depends on begins to come undone. I'm just going to give a quick anecdote. The Royal Society of Canada had a really good conference on the World Trade Organization, yes or no, just in Ottawa a few weeks ago. The chief negotiating lawyers, trade lawyers for our government were there, as well as a member of the secretariat of the OECD. And the most interesting feature of it, as I observed them in action and in debate, they are utterly incapable of appreciating a counter-argument to any of their positions. They just blinker it out. It's not a question as they come up with the lies, although those will come. It's just a question of not being able to engage. You're dealing here with programmed people. And interesting, on the street, I then went out on the street, and I just tell a little anecdote, and here was this three-level riot police with all in their Darth Vader uniforms and so forth, and these kids playing and celebrating in a center about 40 feet from them, everybody terrorized by them. And I found myself moving towards them and standing in front of them and just trying to stare through their visors, to see through to their eyes, see through to the humanity. And then I just shook my head. When I did that, the biggest of the member broke rank, a guy about 6'5", broke his rank out of the middle of them and ran towards me and went like this with his big steel baton and said, "You're a threat. You're shaking your head." And I really think, in reflection, is not only absurd, this is the symptom of the totalitarian society we're going to, but I think he's right. If you shake your head, you are to this system. The new totalitarianism is ultimately an American confidence game, which rules the world by images and projections of power arcing over the globe's surface, while limitlessly rapacious financial sequences called free flows of capital and commodities strip the world's peoples and their life ground underneath. The evidence is all around. The meta pattern is most globally fatal with the planetary ecosystem, but it has played out catastrophically on the social level in Russia, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and Southeast Asia since 1990. But never is the private and centralized financial control of these operations raised publicly as an issue. Nor is the control of the money used by private investment banks and the financial divisions of corporations, whose revenues are based on generated on the basis of creating over 95% of the world's money demand is created by private financial institutions themselves. Thus, the omnipresent center of the interlocked global financial system can deprive hundreds of millions of citizens of their mere means of existence or their life security overnight, through debt issuance and withdrawal of debt issuance, with no exposure of the foreign private powers behind the control of the world money supply constitutionally vested, in fact, in national governments. It's never raised as an issue. It's an unspeakable. So the question arises, where is the failed global experiment of this totalizing rule by private corporate power ever raised? Where has it ever even spoken, whispered inside our government caucuses? The ground of the silence in even social science classrooms is that this monopolist program has become internalized as a public value set. That's the key. The omnipresent center is in this way made more invisible and unaccountable as it spreads. It's inside. The public signifiers and meanings to it are increasingly ruled out in the steering media to set the public mind lock upon which this totalitarian system depends. All become secret in the war with no end to ensure closure against the public even knowing the lines of this world advance. And you notice the newest tactic, which was never available before. We're at war, Bush the other night. We're at war. Anytime any embarrassing question, we're at war. Can't talk about that. To sustain acquiescence in the sacrifices it requires, final section, a totalitarian movement must keep its subjects off balance by a non-stop succession of disruptive changes and demands. Private fear for one's security is a necessary condition across communicatively isolated citizens for their submission to such a regime. the violation of long-accepted norms presented as fait accomplis, and the loss of life bearings by permanent threat to secure livelihood are the psychological operations which are at work in any totalitarian movement. To keep the majority in a continual state of inner anxiety works because people are made too busy securing or competing for their own survival to cooperate in mounting an effective response. In the past decade, the entire population of the globe has been kept permanently off balance with one financial meltdown and transnational trade fiat after another. Notice how they're moving ahead with those rapidly now. After emptying national coffers and overriding rights of the domestic self-determination. Populations have been so overwhelmed by the moving juggernaut of economic and environmental crises that a rule of universal insecurity has rendered social majorities paralyzed by a low-intensity terror, the necessary condition for any totalitarian movement to continue its advance. For keeping its subjects perpetually off balance is its modus operandi. That is why in the Afghanistan case, the war no sooner seems over than the cry goes up, who is next? You have to keep it moving. Arendt's 1955 study, The Origins of Totalitarianism, is confined, quote, to the only two forms of totalitarianism we know, Nazism and Stalinism. But Arendt warns in words that are not remembered that totalitarianism is, quote, a never-present danger grounded in the endless process of capital and power accumulation. Those are Hannah Arendt's words, which erupts past former historical and social limits by, quote, alliance with classless masses, with the negative solidarity. This is the immediate, well, I'll get onto that in a moment. Arendt's far-seeing overview of endless capital accumulation mobilizing as an overwhelming social force by alliance with classless masses is revealingly silent in even scholarly texts on Arendt's work. This is all part of the silent collaboration and in complacent analyses of totalitarianism as only elsewhere. The agenda of thought is rather distant rogue states or shadowy foreign terrorists which are ever ready as new pretexts for more mechanisms of social repression. The negative solidarity of atomized masses, that's Arendt's term, which remains is a mental pulp incapable of mutual life defense and manipulatable by any new scheme of war fever, attack the poor populism, or as in Ontario, civil self-destruction. Totalitarianism is thus always accompanied by a public communication culture of formulaic discourse and bizarre extremes. Beneath communication, totalitarianism is a pathological solution to these very insecure and atomized life bearings, which it appears to remedy with a homogenized unity, as we saw in the 1930s with fascism, or as we see after the 9/11 crisis. In the latter case, orchestration of patriotic fervor overrides popular awareness of a collapsing internal economy, an illegitimate presidential vote, and rising forces of life ground opposition. In fact, however, the new unity is false-bottomed. The civil vacuum is not resolved, but exploited to occupy with the restructuring of democracy by the new order. And thus, the permanent war against terrorists of the Third World is, in fact, and it goes on, it's not just this one, the cap of a continuous and historically unprecedented financial deregulation of markets and hemorrhages of non-transnationally mobile capital in and out of nations, leading to meltdowns from Brazil and Mexico to Russia and Asia. The pace of reengineering of society's economic bases has been dizzying, as all such movements require to keep destabilizing expectations. Within a decade, the world has been made to serve the only legitimate value set now permissible, my particular interest, the only value set you can talk about in public discourse, private investor value, a condition overtly celebrated as bringing a brutal global competition to survive. Well, the most notorious characteristic of totalitarianism, and I now move into my last page, is the a pervasive overriding of the distinction between fact and fiction by saturating mass media falsehoods, masquerading as self-evident truth. And the familiar form of totalitarianism, the big lie, occurs in a moving ad hoc form, typically targeting an internal group for systematic attack by brutal persecution and filling the news with false portrayals of an external enemy. The traditional form of the big lie targets a highly symbolic event, the Reichstag fire or the U.S. Trade Center attack, or a claimed enemy of the populace, communists, or Islamic extremists. Global corporate totalitarianism, however, is not plausibly distinguishable as totalitarian in this way. Although the targeting in the U.S. and Latin America backyard of Soviet-led communists to justify persecution of hundreds of thousands of people by death squads and orchestrated military pogroms was a lead-up to the present corporate system. What interests here, however, is a more routine and pervasive form of the big lie. The big lie, in the sense of omnipervasive lie, is disseminated by round-the-clock, centrally controlled multimedia, which are watched, read, or heard by people across the globe day and night without break, in the occupation of public consciousness instead of national territories. Groupthink, not soil, is the breeding ground of the new totalitarianism. On the micro level, the omnipresent lie operates through a total conditioning process, not only through continuous television, newspaper, car and home radio, disc and film, mass programming across private and social life, but increasingly against the citizen's will by unstoppable phone calls and messages, ad mail and corporate flyers occupying mailboxes and home entrances, and round-the-clock invasions of fields of sight and hearing by demands to buy corporate commodities. I was on the phone the other day with Adbusters, who phoned me to want to inquire about my work, and right in the middle of the conversation, we were disconnected. So some phone calls more than others, okay? Eventually compounded by corporate security state systems to, quote, put all people in jail simply for participating in a political protest. What is in common among all these saturating occupations of citizen sense organs, it is that all their statements and images are false and misleading as a form of communication. Typically, they are voluminously trivial, with no meaning beyond their occurrence, or repetitions of mind-shackling misrepresentations in high decibel certitudes. And the key one, the key master lie is this one, that the politically imposed, not economically, the politically imposed global corporate system calling itself the global free market, that politically imposed global corporate system equals the free market, equals democracy, equals the solution to poverty. And just on and on and on. Never stop. Questions do not arise in such a total sign field. Indeed, there's no ground of truth from which to raise them, for no criterion of truth or falsehood exists within this knowledge economy. This is its quintessentially totalitarian feature. Across the increasingly invasive occupations of all attention fields by corporate ad vehicles, including school classrooms and public policy meetings, the regulating standard overriding all others is more sales for more profits to oligopolist corporations. In the old totalitarian culture of the big lie, the truth is hidden. In the new totalitarianism, there is no line between truth and falsehood. Thank you.
And we've got some microphones set up here on each side. So if you just come to your microphone, I see Michael Volpe over here on my left. Michael?
Professor McMurtry, the last time I heard words so as depressing as yours is when I read Francis Fukuyama's The End of History and his triumphal declaration that market liberalism had triumphed for all times. Are you really that pessimistic? Do you not see any optimism or grounds for optimism in Seattle, in Windsor, in Quebec City, in the democracy conferences? I mean, even Jeffrey Simpson has written a book saying we're living in a one-party state. So, you know, do you see some grounds for optimism?
Yes, if I'd had more time, I was going to go in for some of those. I think we're, as the title of my in the work's book goes, value wars, that we're very much in a value war, or based on that. And it's between the values of life in all the variations that we have from the opposition. It's always some form of life protective concern they have, whether it's against GMOs or for subsistence farmers or whatever. That's the unifying structure of all the opposition movement. And I think it's precisely, I would go further. I just want to analyze, diagnose this latest moment, the war in Afghanistan. I think it's precisely because of the success of these movements. It's precisely, and if I'd had more time, I would have read why I thought it occurred just when it occurred. It happened as the height. I mean, every time there was a WTO demonstration, it got bigger, no matter how bad the beatings, the gassings, the clubbings, etc. The demonstrations got bigger, and across the world, across continents. And we had a president who was the laughingstock of the world and moreover illegitimate. And we had, really, I think, I wondered when I saw the demonstration in Quebec, I thought to myself, they don't know what they're doing any longer. They have so delinked from what I call the life ground that they have no resources left. And in my manuscript, I'm saying this, I'm asking this question, and then boom, 9/11 occurred. It was just like, what are they going to do next? Because it was clear they were in a panic. They did not know how to respond to people's concerns, which was obviously out of their ken. They couldn't understand it. And so they just came across with propagandist declarations. Since 9/11, just to go on, because I completely agree with you, I think 9/11 has been, as it were, permitted in the way that past assassinations, Pearl Harbor itself, back further, have been, as it were, constructed, allowed, and why was, and there's a lot of evidence for that, but I don't want to get into that now, is precisely because of the success of the opposition, which is moving across the world. And it really does join people in an unprecedented way, and across cultures, languages, socioeconomic positions. And it's very interesting, since 9/11, in Europe, we live in as it were, the center of the totalitarian bubble. And I think it's a PR totalitarianism. I mean, Canada is very much like the U.S. in this way. But in Europe, you know how many people support the Afghanistan war in Greece, the place that democracy started? 8%. There's no place in Europe where more than 22%, other than Britain, which is just a captive state, as you know. Great book by the Bombio on that very title, by the way, on just how much corporations are right inside their decision-making apparatuses. Outside of Britain, and even Britain, the figures have fallen by almost 20% in the last week or so. 65% and 66% of Germany and France, respectively, are against the war in Afghanistan. This was weeks ago. So I think that, you know, they've discharged in this, and that's why they have to have a permanent war. This is a war with no end. This is a war we can never say is over. Is precisely because of the strength of the opposition, which I call the rising of the life ground.
Thank you, John. Barry Zwicker from Vision TV Mediafile. In this same room, just a couple or 3 years ago, Michael Parenti said that they don't know when to stop. There's no sense of proportion when it comes to the greed. And you said something similar. And insofar as we could look, it seems that the Bush regime is tremendously emboldened. What overstepping do you foresee that would help to trigger serious resistance? I mean, this room is pretty full. It's great, but there should be standing room only. What oversteppings would you foresee?
It's hard to see that it hasn't. All the oversteppings haven't already occurred. And this is why I think it's, a society's only as good as the people in it and their understanding of what's their ability to oppose these kinds of things. I think we're really in a movement, and despite what Michael and I share our view of that there's a rising of the life ground, they have overstepped every bound. I'm really... It takes the breath away, as I said inside that talk. It takes the breath away, but what are they going to do next? I mean, they took the election. I mean, just what's next? And I really think it's a matter of like a collective trance of the people captured inside a mass superstition, because it's all this talk about the market and the invisible hand and growth, and, you know, it's basically just cover stories for money sequencing without limit. So I think it's really up to the action of understanding of the people.
I'm going to take one more question from each mic, and that's all. I'm sorry. Over here.
My name is Michel Dugré. I'm a garment worker. I agree that the source of the war against Afghanistan has to be found not in Afghanistan, but in the United States or in Canada or France. It's rooted in what they cannot achieve in their own countries, what the capitalist rulers cannot achieve in their own countries. They cannot reverse the decline of the rate of profit, and are driven to more and more commercial wars against each other and more to wars. But the point I wanted to make is that this is not a sign of strength on their side. They're driven to war because nothing else works. And even in Afghanistan, you can see that. They can kill people. They can overthrow a government. They can even probably build a pipeline through Afghanistan. They will not be able to stabilize the situation there. They will not be able to put in place a dictatorship or a protectorate like they did in the 50s, because they cannot buy out a middle class that, you know, could identify with their domination like they did in Congo or in even Spain or Portugal or during the 50s. And so what you see today, the other side of the thing, is that they cannot defeat people, really. Like, they cannot defeat the Palestinians. They cannot defeat the Irish who fight against UK domination in Ireland. They cannot defeat the Quebecois. They won't be able to stabilize this thing. And it's already there, the opposition. That's the form it takes. Just to finish, last week they had to jail 200 teachers in New Jersey for defying an injunction. They can't do that. They are the ruling class, the capitalist rulers. But these teachers were not defeated. They were defiant, in fact, even when they went in and out of jail. And so, but you're learning through that. Working people are learning through these experiences that, you know, the problem is right here. It's not in Afghanistan. The terrorists, like you said, are right here, right here in this country.
I don't think that the falling rate of profit explains all that's going on in terms of this. I think there has to be outlets, and I think the public sector is the new colonies of the world of what you can move your money sequences. I always have to have a greater accumulation to go to the next terrain. It always has more. It has to find more places to, quote, invest in, or more to sequence to return profits. And I think that we have it's driven by a totalitarian logic by its nature. It has to go everywhere in order to find new outlets, new markets, and so forth. And there's none left. Therefore, and I think since 1980, it's turned on itself. It's turned on itself in the public sectors. It's the stripping of the public sectors and the privatization of them is, I think, where the ultimate action of the world is going on. And the Afghanistan war is a demonstration war of dealing with symptoms and the reign of terror that must, in fact, be instituted to terrify people into obedience to the earth that's being stripped right in front of them, not only the natural earth, but their own basic victories of hundreds of years of history. Totalitarianisms always collapse. They always collapse suddenly, without warning. I think even in Ontario we had that kind of mood going on, and all of a sudden that particular front face is gone, and they have to coin a new one. Well, they succeed at this. I think I agree. It's coming. It will definitely come to the to an end. The question is how much will be destroyed first, and I think that's back to the action of understanding and why it's important. I think shaking, as it were, and this is the one thing it cannot deal with. I think where it functions on the basis of terror and trance, and we're right at the apogee of that.
Last question.
You made an interesting analogy between Nazi Germany of the 1930s with the burning of the Reichstag to the United States of 2001. I think that you were as well saying that with Pearl Harbor that was kind of allowed
by... Well, there seems to be a lot of evidence,
allowed by the United States to, in order to justify getting into the war, and that the events perhaps of September 11th were also allowed by the United States to propagate this
for
war.
For wholly different kinds of reasons,
I'm wondering, what would you say should be the reaction of the United States and the West, whoever it may be, to the events of September the 11th that are different or would be different in your view from what has taken place?
Well, I think that a lot of what's going on is the delegitimation, but everybody seems to be afraid to say that, and I'm going to quote, I was in California a while ago, and I was on the stage with David Corton, who many of you might know. The guy wrote When Corporations Rule the World and other good work. And we were the two speakers. And he said, and this was not so long, a few weeks after, and he said to a larger audience than is here, he said, and we'd been arguing about it all day, but he was on the negative side, but he said to the people, right out of the blue, he said, I think when I first saw this 9/11 event, I said, this is a setup. And there was this long, long pause. Nobody in a large California American audience, nobody protested. Nobody challenged, because there was a question period after. And I really think that until then, nobody dared say it, but then people, it was out, and everybody shared the view. And I think this is this delegitimation of what's going on, because the whole thing functions as, the Patriotism Act and so forth, is that seeing through it, and not only seeing through it, but being bold about declaring about seeing through it, is really the key, again, to undo the trance.
What I'm asking, I guess, is what are you suggesting that the response of the United States or the West should have been? To the events of September the 11th, whether they were created by the United States or others. I'm not sure what it is that you're saying there.
Well, I mean, the way it was all set up by the ISA, Pakistan, and so forth, there were so many, that's why the first sentence I gave in giving my talk was to understand this as a process. That if you isolate a single moment of the process, you lose your bearings, and there's precisely that fragmentation and isolation into a single event that they depend upon to sustain the trance. It's a process, and that process can be tracked right back to when they first started funding these people and so on, and this was one moment of a long process that is embedded in a larger, wider global process, and so the response... I suppose would be to wake up with what you're actually doing on the governing levels, those who aren't part of the gang, which is, not.
No, I'm sorry, but I've got to. We've got to move on. And.
Well, I think the normal processes of law are already available in spades for dealing with that kind of terrorist act that killed lots of people, not only Americans. I think there's a lot of law in place and a lot of law and apprehension of what was going on existed before September 11th, and it wasn't acted on. So I think the normal processes of law, we have a rule of law, we operate in accordance with the rule of law, and what has been distinguished this whole process is, just as everything else is doing, it's lawless from beginning to end.
That was Professor John McMurtry of the University of Guelph speaking last month in Toronto. Thanks to Neil Mather of Radio Cognito for that tape.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by